partner. But with practice, mindfulness increases our awareness of what we're experiencing with our partners and allows us the space to determine how we want to act and react with them. When you're able to bypass emotional reactions with your spouse or partner, you feel more centered, calm, and capable of resolving issues in a loving manner. This ability alone can save you from days and even years of mental and emotional distress that depletes your emotional energy. Mindfulness isn't about denying or burying our emotions, says psychologist and author Dr. Lisa Firestone in an article for Psychology Today. It's simply about cultivating a different relationship to our feelings and experiences, in which we're in the driver's seat. We can see our feelings and thoughts like a passing train roaring through the station. But we alone choose if we want to get on board. Choosing not to get on board is the beginning of a conscious relationship that promotes healing and intimacy, rather than discord and divisiveness. Here are some simple actions you can take to become more present in your marriage or love relationship. Make the commitment. With the awareness that mindfulness will improve the quality of your connection with your partner, commit yourself to practicing this habit on a daily basis. If you spend years in an unconscious relationship in which you and your partner are reactive, it'll take some time to retrain yourself to interact differently. But if you're motivated to grow in your relationship and reduce stress in your life, you can change. This is the most important relationship in your life, and it impacts your mental health and your outlook on everything. Commit to this one practice in your relationship and you'll see an improvement in all areas of your life. Put a note in a place you'll see it first thing in the morning to remind you to be present with your spouse when you interact. You may need reminders in several places in the house when you begin this practice. Communicate your commitment. Your decision to be more mindful with your partner isn't predicated by your partner's mutual commitment, but it certainly helps. Sit down with your spouse when you can talk without interruption and let him or her know about your new plan. You might say something like, "I've decided I want to be more present and compassionate in my relationship with you. It'll make us closer and will help us resolve our differences without as much anger or hurt. I've made a commitment to this, and I'd like it if you'd commit to it as well." Your spouse may wonder exactly what this means, and this leads to the other actions in this chapter that you can practice. Be emotionally present. Being emotionally present means being fully attuned to your partner in conversation. If your partner is in pain, it means remaining emotionally open to the pain and showing empathy. It also means paying attention to your partner's body language and reflecting it back, as well as using eye contact, gentle touch, and nodding to show you hear your partner. It generally doesn't mean offering suggestions or ways to fix a situation unless your partner asks for that. In fact, we block our intimate ability for emotional presence when we try to do something more for our partner. Attuned presence allows your partner to feel less alone with his or her feelings. This kind of emotional resonance with your spouse leads to more intimacy, trust, and security in your relationship. Listen without defensiveness. When you and your partner have a conflict or emotionally charged conversation, presence means you listen without preparing your response or defense. Be aware of your own reactive emotions. Name them and recognize that they've been triggered, but don't act on them. Try to pull your attention back to your partner's words and acknowledge that your partner's feelings are as important as your own. Reflect back to your partner. The willingness to reflect back to your partner the words you hear from them shows that you're actively listening. It also reinforces for your spouse that you care enough to seek to fully understand what they're saying to you. Reflecting back isn't simply parroting what your partner says. It's a way of confirming that what you heard is actually what your partner meant. It opens dialogue for clarification and invites discussion about mutual resolution and understanding. This is a highly valuable mindfulness technique during times of conflict, hurt feelings, or misunderstandings. Communicate authentically. Being present with your partner is a mature relationship skill. It means you can't respond or react in childlike ways, using passive-aggressive words or behaviors like eye-rolling, the silent treatment, or sulking. Throwing tantrums or having angry outbursts always prevents open, authentic communication. When you have an issue with your spouse, rather than taking a jab at them or making a disparaging comment, turn back to the practice of mindfulness. Pay attention to your emotions and wait until you are calm and less defensive before initiating a conversation. Share the issue without blame or criticism. State your perception of the issue, how it made you feel, and what you need from your partner in order to restore your connection. Listen to your partner's response and perspective without defensiveness. Look for lessons within conflict. We mentioned earlier that your love relationship is the laboratory for personal growth if you pay attention. Conflict is uncomfortable and unpleasant, but it provides the perfect opportunity for learning. Rather than stewing in your angry juices after a conflict, ask yourself these questions. Is it possible that I'm not entirely right? Is my partner's perspective valid to some extent? Am I being the person I want to be with my partner? What have I learned from this conflict? What is the deeper issue triggering my reactions? How are my wounded feelings getting in the way of my growth? How do I want to change as a result of this interaction? Your answers to these questions will foster healing and self-awareness and allow you to break free from the inner critic who keeps you agitated and angry. Spend quality time with your partner without distraction. One of the most valuable things you can do for the health of your relationship is to spend quality time with your partner. This is time when you're both relaxed and engaged without the pressures of work, children, or conflict. Busy couples often have to schedule this time because life is so hectic and demanding. If that's the case for you, make a point to arrange a regular date or even 30 minutes of daily quiet time with your spouse where you can talk and reconnect. The more emotional intimacy you share with your partner, the more you insulate your relationship from the conflicts that create suffering for you both. Putting in this effort is an investment in your peace of mind and mental clarity. Relationship strategy number 4. Let go of certain people. Decluttering your relationships sometimes means just that, letting go of people who cause you suffering. Sometimes the only course of action is to say goodbye to those who continue to undermine your mental and emotional health. Letting go of a relationship is painful, even if it's draining you, holding you back, blinding you to your true self, or, worse yet, toxic or abusive. We invest a lot in our friendships, our marriages, our business partners, and our family members. Quite often it's one of these close relationships, a person or people with whom we've been intimately and deeply involved for many years, that cause us the most pain and turmoil. At some point in one of these relationships, you'll reach the point where the pain and difficulty outweigh the positives, where the fallout of letting go seems less daunting than the misery of staying put. For instance, one of the hardest things Steve ever had to do was to cut off all communication with an ex-girlfriend. After an extremely frustrating year-long relationship, he felt that there was no way he could have her in his life, even as a friend. Their interaction was just too toxic for both people to find any happiness around one another. So he made the decision to force a permanent separation by going to Europe and spending 8 months traveling without any access to a cell phone. While it was challenging, Steve knew that the only way to move on was to create a cold turkey situation, where it would be almost impossible for the two of them to have any sort of conversation. Now, you don't have to leave your country in order to escape from a bad relationship, but you might want to consider taking a proactive approach to eliminate certain people from your life. And make sure you stick to this plan. We'll admit it's not easy to make this final decision, but there are some universal themes of discord in any kind of relationship that reveal it's time to say goodbye. These include verbal, emotional, or physical abuse, consistent dishonesty, disloyalty or deceit, divergent core values or questionable integrity, general toxicity, negativity, and incompatibility, consistent, harmful irresponsibility, ongoing immaturity and emotional manipulation, unresolved or untreated mental health issues, addictions, drugs, alcohol, sex, gambling, pornography, refusal to communicate, address problems, or invest in the relationship. Beyond these more serious situations, sometimes a relationship simply runs its course. You may find, for reasons you don't completely understand, that another person diminishes your life more than enlivens it. You may come to a point where you simply don't wish to deal with the emotional clutter and chaos another person creates in your life. If the person causing your suffering happens to be your spouse, a parent or family member, or an adult child, you can't just abandon the relationship without serious repercussions, but you can better manage these relationships and protect your mental health by creating strong boundaries and communicating your boundaries to the person involved. You can learn more about creating relationship boundaries in this post on Barry's blog, Live Bold and Bloom. If you have difficult parents and extended family members who are causing you angst, you can learn how to deal with them in this article. Or if your marriage is unhappy and you're considering divorce, you might want to check out this post. Of course, managing or letting go of any relationship is not a quick proposition. It could take months or years and a lot of heartache to detach from someone who's been a part of your life in any significant way. But we'd be remiss if we didn't include this point as part of your mental declutter options. Here are some thoughts on how to remove yourself from a draining or painful relationship. Consider the positives of life without this person. Letting go of a relationship might feel like you're giving up or being unkind. You might feel guilty if you step away from this person. But if the relationship is causing you regular discomfort, you are not treating yourself with respect. If you're having trouble deciding whether or not to end or contain the relationship, think about how your life would feel if you didn't have this person around you. Would you feel relieved, liberated, less anxious or stressed? Ask yourself how your life might change for the better if you didn't have to cope with the problems and concerns associated with your interactions with this person. Your judgment might be clouded by your feelings of guilt or obligation, but try to honestly weigh the positives of letting go. Consider the fallout of saying goodbye. Ending a relationship rarely occurs without some fallout. Your decision will likely impact other people close to you, forcing them to choose sides or at least take some kind of stand, which might not be in your favor. Some people might cut you off as a result. The person you're saying goodbye to may try to sabotage you, talk behind your back, or wound you in some way. Their reaction may be more dramatic or damaging than you anticipated, causing things to get worse before they get better. You might find the loss of the relationship more painful than you thought it would be. Then you second-guess yourself. It's valuable to think through all of the possible repercussions before you end the relationship. How will each of these scenarios make you feel? Can you handle the fallout, or do you find it more damaging than maintaining a draining relationship? Define what goodbye really means. Letting go might mean a permanent end to a relationship where there's no communication or interaction at all. But this isn't possible or reasonable for all relationships. Goodbye might also mean letting go of the old way of relating to this person and implementing a new, more self-protective way. Relationships you have with family members, adult children, or former spouse can't always be cut off entirely. But you can create boundaries around the time you spent with these people and how you communicate with them in order to protect your mental and emotional health. Decide what goodbye means for you exactly. How much time are you willing to spend with this person? How do you wish to communicate with them, and how often? What will you no longer tolerate in your interactions with them? Being proactive about these decisions makes you feel more in control and calm about how to move forward. Communicate your intentions without blame. Simply dropping a friend or family member cold turkey with no explanation or conversation might be the easy way out, but it isn't the kindest way. Yes, this person might be draining every last drop of energy and joy out of you, but they're still deserving of an explanation, or at least a heads up. You don't need to get into a long, drawn-out conflict in order to say goodbye or cut back on your interactions, nor do you need to assign blame or cast aspersions. Try to take the high road and say what you would want to hear if the shoe were on the other foot. Person-to-person conversations are generally the best way to have this talk. But you know this person best. If you anticipate a lot of drama or anger, then maybe a letter or phone call is better than meeting in person. Either way, try to keep it short and focus on your own feelings rather than their faults. You might say something like, "I need a break from our friendship because I feel like we're out of sync and it's causing me distress. I care about you, but I need to step away. I didn't want to back off without saying something first." Create a plan for a negative reaction. No matter how kindly you end a relationship, the other person, and perhaps others you're both associated with, will react badly. It's hard to anticipate how someone might react when they're hurt or angry. Try to prepare for this potential fallout in advance. This might mean you ask a support person to be with you when you communicate your intentions, as well as after the difficult conversation. You might need to talk personally about your plan to end this relationship with friends and family who know the other person. Try to explain your need to end the relationship without bad-mouthing the other person if possible. Depending on the intensity and longevity of the relationship you're ending, you might need the help of a therapist so you can navigate your own feelings of loss and pain. Accept that it can be a process. For some relationships, letting go is a slow backing away over time. Or it might be an ending followed by a period of reconciliation, only to result in a more permanent ending. Sometimes guilt, confusion, or loneliness can make you second-guess your decision to let go. It takes going back to the relationship to cement your determination to finally end it. Recognize that letting go of someone who was once close to you is rarely easy or pain-free. Give yourself permission to do it slowly if that's the best way for you. Allow yourself to grieve. The ending of a relationship that was once close or that you hoped would someday work out is painful. Yes, you may feel relief that you don't have to deal with the difficult aspects of the relationship. You may have more emotional energy and fewer daily frustrations. However, grief has a way of sneaking up on us when we least expect it. Any process of letting go can create a pocket of grief that needs time to heal. Don't try to talk yourself out of your grief or second-guess your decision because your grief is confusing. If you view grief as a normal part of the process of letting go, it will pass through you more quickly, allowing you to regain the peace of mind and joy that was diminished during the relationship. As you can see, eliminating people from your life can be challenging, but also rewarding because it frees you up to spend time with the people who truly matter. In the next section, we'll go over the fourth area that you can declutter in order to reduce stress, anxiety, and a feeling overwhelming your life. Let's get to it. Part 4. Decluttering your surroundings. The value of decluttering your surroundings. If people concentrated on the really important things in life, there'd be a shortage of fishing poles. Doug Larson. Where you choose to spend time every day ultimately determines the quality of your life. We know that's an obvious statement, but many people fail to analyze what they do on a moment-to-moment, day-by-day basis. In fact, we tend to allow happenstance, boredom, or other people to determine how we spend a lot of our time. We react to what's in front of us, instead of mindfully deciding how we want to create our lives. We talked earlier about defining your values, life priorities, goals, and life passion. These actions help you direct the daily activities of your life. But you can't focus on these big-picture actions all day, every day. That's because the bulk of your time is often filled with mindless tasks that contribute to feelings of overwhelm, emptiness, and mental clutter. We've become attached to things, routines, and environments. We allow our homes to become repositories for every new whim as we accumulate more and more stuff over the years. We're obsessed with technology and spend hours on social media, taking and sharing selfies, and documenting the minutia of our lives. So to get the full benefit of mental decluttering your life, you need to address the more mundane but potentially depleting aspects of daily life. These mindless activities are the small holes in the dam that allow your energy and joy to seep out. With a few changes, you can plug the holes and refill your tank. In this section, we'll tackle the final step of the process. How to declutter your immediate surroundings in order to free up mental space for the important goals and people in your life. Simplify your home. Have nothing in your house that you do not know to be useful or believe to be beautiful. William Morris. Your home should be a haven, a place where you feel peaceful, happy, and calm. But can you feel this way when your home is cluttered with stuff? Researchers at the Princeton University Neuroscience Institute published the results of a study they conducted in the Journal of Neuroscience that relates directly to uncluttered and organized living. According to their report, interactions of top-down and bottom-up mechanisms in human visual cortex. Multiple stimuli present in the visual field at the same time compete for neural representation by mutually suppressing their evoked activity throughout visual cortex, providing a neural correlate for the limited processing capacity of the visual system. In other words, when your environment is cluttered, the visual chaos restricts your ability to focus. The clutter also limits your brain's ability to process information. Clutter distracts you so you're unable to process information as well as you would in an uncluttered, organized, and serene environment. For a moment, visualize a room with minimal furniture, free of clutter and extraneous knickknacks. The room is tidy, organized, and minimal. See yourself sitting in this room and notice how you feel. Now visualize a room packed with furniture, magazines, and books stacked on the tables, and every surface adorned with clutter and stuff. How do you feel sitting in this room? Clutter steals your focus, making you feel overwhelmed, distracted, and agitated. Your brain is so busy trying to process all of the visual stimuli, that you can't fully enjoy the moment. Now, maybe you feel sentimental about many of the objects in your home, but we invite you to embrace a new mindset about physical clutter and how it impacts your mental health. Decluttering your home might be a process that takes several iterations before you feel comfortable saying goodbye to things. But by simply starting the process, you'll be surprised at the positive impact it has on your energy and state of mind. Steve and Barry have written about how to declutter your home in their book, 10-Minute Declutter, The Stress-Free Habit for Simplifying Your Home, where you'll find detailed ideas on decluttering and organizing every room in your house. You can declutter your home in less time than you think, and without feeling completely overwhelmed, when you tackle it in small chunks of time every day. Set aside just 10 minutes a day to work on your clutter, and within a few weeks, your house will be in order. Here's a 10-step process from the book to help you get started. 1. Set up a staging area. You'll need a place to temporarily stage all of the items you want to store elsewhere or give away. Find a room or space in your house where you can place these things until you're ready to deal with them. You may decide to create a staging area in each room you're working on rather than one main area. This works just fine as well, just as long as you don't mind having a pile of stuff sitting in a corner of the room. 2. Get boxes for the staging area. You'll need boxes in varying sizes for staging items to donate, give to other people, sell, or put into storage. Use inexpensive cardboard boxes for staging purposes. Later, you can purchase more durable storage containers for any items you want to store. 3. Have a timer, notebook, and pen handy. Since you'll be working in 10-minute increments, set a timer so you'll know when to stop. You'll be surprised at how much you can accomplish in 10 minutes. Also, keep a notebook and pen with you as you declutter and organize. You'll want to make notes on organizing supplies you may need to purchase or ideas you have for storage, donation, or selling items. 4. Set up a schedule. Setting up a 10-minute declutter schedule means you're adding a new habit to your day, which can be hard. Creating habits requires a few special skills to make sure you don't give up. Choose the time of day you want to perform your declutter habit. Make sure it immediately follows a previously established habit, like having coffee in the morning or brushing your teeth. This trigger will cue you to perform your declutter habit. Then reward yourself after you perform your new habit. For more on this, check out Steve's article on How to Build a Habit in 8 Steps. 5. Begin where you spend most of your time. If you're confused about where to start your decluttering and organizing project, we suggest you begin where you spend the most time. For most people, that would be the kitchen, bedrooms, and family room. When you complete a room you use a lot, you'll get a great feeling of satisfaction, as well as a boost of emotional energy and peace of mind. 6. Determine your system. In order to keep your work to 10 minutes a day, consider moving through spaces top to bottom, left to right. For example, in your kitchen, begin with the top shelves of cabinets and declutter, clean the shelves on the left side first, then move to the right. Remove everything from the left side shelves, then quickly sort what you know you want to put back onto the shelves. Wipe the shelf clean, and then replace the items you want to keep. Put the remaining items in the appropriate boxes to give away, sell, donate, or store elsewhere. With drawers, do the same thing. Dump everything out, sort the absolute keepers, wipe out the drawer, replace the keepers, and then put the rest in the appropriate boxes. 7. Avoid indecision. One reason people have a hard time decluttering is because they can't decide whether or not to let something go. There are a million and one reasons for this confusion, but you need to deal with indecision in the moment to successfully declutter. That's why we suggest you put only the absolute keepers back in the spaces you've decluttered. Get rid of anything you know for sure you don't want or need. Anything you feel slightly ambivalent about or rarely use, put into a storage box to deal with later. Label the box, seal it up, and put it into a storage room. 8. Work quickly. Have you noticed how easy it is to get distracted when you're cleaning and organizing? You pick something up, look at it, think about it, wonder what to do with it. With a 10-minute system, you've created a sense of urgency for yourself. You're trying to accomplish a task in a short amount of time. That's why it's so important to replace only the items you know you need. You can deal with the other questionable items later. You may discover you don't need them at all after living without them in sight for a while. 9. Tell your family. Be sure you inform those who live in the house with you that you're working on this declutter project. Better yet, ask for their support and help to complete the project even more quickly. At the very least, you want to be sure they don't come behind you and reclutter the spaces you've completed. If you have kids, it's great to get them involved in 10-minute cleanup projects. They'll enjoy racing against the clock to complete a task. 10. Enjoy the process. Even the smallest accomplishments afford a great sense of satisfaction and pride. Every day, you'll complete a small task that will lead to a streamlined, organized, tidy home. But rather than seeing these daily tasks as simply a means to that end, try to enjoy each 10-minute chunk of time. Put on some music and make it fun. Give yourself a nice reward once you complete the task. A cup of tea, reading for a few minutes, or a walk outside. Marie Kondo, author of the book, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, says, "The space in which we live should be for the person we are becoming now, not for the person we were in the past. If you have a strong attachment to the past, whether through your thinking or your clutter, you cause yourself suffering. Let go. Release the physical objects that weigh you down. Focus your mind and your daily life on the present, and you'll feel liberated and unencumbered."
Simplify your digital life. There's a lot of good that comes from the explosion of technology and digital communication. It's definitely made our lives easier, faster, and more productive. But there's a diminishing point of return with our devotion to digital devices. We've become obsessed with technology, and it's impacting every aspect of how we live our lives. We are slaves to the gadgets that were supposed to simplify our lives, and prefer the quick fix of instant information and low-quality entertainment over real-world interactions and experiences. We spend hours on social media. Our inboxes are flooded. Our desktops are littered. Our laptops are bursting at the seams with more documents, photos, and downloads that we can absorb in a lifetime. Digital stuff has an insidious way of occupying your time with non-essential activities. And just like physical clutter in your home, digital clutter creates feelings of anxiety, agitation, and overwhelm. In the book, 10-Minute Digital Declutter, The Simple Habit to Eliminate Technology Overload, Barry and Steve remind, if you add up the time spent on each digital device every day, then you probably have a closer relationship with the virtual world than you have with your spouse, children, or friends. You know there's something wrong with this balance, and yet you still find yourself flipping open the lid or gazing at your iPhone whenever you have a moment to spare, or even when you don't. Is this really how you want to live your life? From this book, we recommend a few actions to consider to support your mental declutter habits. How are you spending your digital time? Take a realistic look at how you spend your time on your devices. Of course, there are necessary online activities for your personal and professional life. But then there are the hours you spend plugged in just surfing the net, playing games, and checking in on social media. Spend a few minutes reviewing your day and add up the non-essential time you spent plugged in. Better yet, document your digital activities throughout the day. You'll be surprised at how much time you give away to virtual experiences. All of this digital input creates agitation and has an addictive quality that pulls you away from more meaningful pursuits that energize you rather than depleting you. Where and how can you begin cutting back? Start with an hour a day that you hold sacred and free from any digital time. Shut down your computer and put your phone into a drawer. What can you do instead of engaging in digital distractions? We suggest you read a book, take a long walk, exercise, talk with a friend, spend quality time with your spouse and children, do something creative like writing or drawing, learn a new skill, meditate, listen to music, ride your bike, finish a project. Do something that is real, in the moment, and positive so that you avoid both the depletion of digital immersion and the secondary feelings of guilt and anxiety that often accompany too much time plugged in. How cluttered have your devices become? Digital clutter sneaks up on you because it's not as visible as the clutter in your home. Before you know it, your desktop is littered with icons, your email inbox is overflowing, and your files and documents are so disorganized you need a search party to help you find anything. If you're like us, your life hinges on the contents of your computer. That may sound dramatic, but if you keep all of your important personal and professional documents and files on your computer, then you know how critical this piece of equipment is to your daily life. It's so easy to allow our computer lives to become the digital equivalent of hoarders. Trying to locate documents and emails wastes your time and causes daily frustration and anxiety. Your smartphone is just another mini-computer you drag around with you in your pocket or purse. It's another place for you to hoard digital stuff that drags you down with excess apps, photos, news feeds, and games. If your devices are bursting at the seams, you feel the weight of that excess whether or not you're aware of it. If you take 10 minutes a day to begin chipping away at the clutter, you'll begin to feel increasingly lighter and unfettered. We suggest you begin where you'll reap the greatest rewards from decluttering your devices. If you're frustrated daily because you can't find a document you need, begin there. If you have heart palpitations every time you see thousands of emails in your inbox, that's the place to start. The key is to just start. What's your digital mindset? It's not news to you that your digital devices, or rather the content on them, cause you mental distress and agitation. None of us like to admit it, but we all know how pervasive the digital world has become in our daily lives. This is not a passing fad that will extinguish over time. It's here to stay. And in all likelihood, it will become increasingly prevalent with every passing year. It's up to you to decide how to manage the digital intrusion on your life and the impact on your mental health. It's important to be proactive in your values and choices related to your digital life. By developing a digital value system, you create personal boundaries that help you manage your time and clutter, both mental and digital. Here are some questions to ask yourself that can be used to create digital boundaries. How much time each day is absolutely necessary for me to spend on my devices for my job? Am I in a job that requires me to spend more time than I want behind my computer? How could I interact face-to-face with people in my work more often? How much time do I want to spend on my home computer doing work? How much time do I want to spend on social media for entertainment? How much time do I want to spend on my smartphone for entertainment? In what situations is a phone call or personal meeting more appropriate than a text? What real-life friendships have I neglected, and how do I want to nurture them? What family or relationship agreements should we have in place about using our smartphones, iPads, or laptops in each other's presence? What traditions or family time, like dinners together, do you want to make sacred and personal, without the presence of digital devices? What limitations or rules should we have for our children's use of digital devices? How should I be a role model to my children related to these rules? When I have downtime, what are the top 5 best ways I should use it? How can I deal with the urges to surf the net or engage in social media when I really don't want to? How will I commit to managing my digital clutter so it doesn't get out of hand? Use your answers to these questions to write down your values and personal commitments related to how you spend your time and energy on and off your devices. You may fall off the wagon from time to time, but now you have a wagon to climb back onto. Simplify your activities. Don't underestimate the value of doing nothing, of just going along, listening to all the things you can't hear, and not bothering. Winnie the Pooh. How many times have you replied to the question, "How are you?" by answering, "I am so busy. Life is crazy right now." When was the last time you or someone you know answered the "How are you?" questions with, "Life is great. I'm really relaxed and doing absolutely nothing." Everyone is in a hurry, doing, doing, doing. But to what end? Why are we filling our to-do lists so we can hurry up and enjoy the leisure time that never seems to materialize? We feel guilty if our hours aren't packed with productive activities that are either income-producing or ego-enlarging. Doing nothing for any extended period feels like failing, even as we continue to develop time-saving technology, gadgets, and devices. The time we gain is quickly sucked up to quell the anxiety created by not enough to do. According to a 2014 article in The Economist, individualistic cultures, which emphasize achievement over affiliation, help cultivate this time-is-money mindset. This creates an urgency to make every moment count, notes Harry Triandis, a social psychologist at the University of Illinois. Do you find yourself running around like a chicken, mindlessly checking items off your list so you feel productive and worthy? Sometimes our schedules take over our lives, and we don't give much thought to whether or not we're spending our time in ways that contribute to the mental clutter and stress that is so debilitating. We get trapped on the treadmill of tasks and obligations, leaving little time for those things that allow us to be present and fully engaged. Omid Safi, director of Duke University's Islamic Studies Center, in an article for On Being with Krista Tippett, says, "What happened to a world in which we can sit with the people we love so much and have slow conversations about the state of our heart and soul? conversations that slowly unfold, conversations with pregnant pauses and silences that we are in no rush to fill. How did we create a world in which we have more and more and more to do with less time for leisure, less time for reflection, less time for community, less time to just be? There's no doubting the fact that it's hard to break free from the busyness trap. We've been brainwashed to believe that idleness is the root of all evil. We're not suggesting that working hard, being productive, and having an active life are bad things. To the contrary, they can contribute to a fulfilling, happy life. But there is a diminishing point of return that creates the opposite effect, making you feel depleted and overwhelmed. Cutting back and expunging non-essential activities can feel uncomfortable and even threatening at first. If I cut back, what will people think? Will I lose income? Will I appear lazy? Will my kids get behind? Will my world fall apart? The first step in cutting back is embracing it as a worthy endeavor, acknowledging that busyness is contributing to your mental clutter and accepting that less really can be more. Here are 8 strategies to declutter your schedule so you can enjoy more of what's truly important. Strategy number 1. Prioritize your daily priorities. Rather than trying to fit in your life priorities around your busy schedule, create space for your priorities first. For example, if spending time with your spouse or kids is a priority, then commit to the time you'll spend with them every day. Don't allow that time to be violated with good reasons that you define in advance. Before you allow a priority to be dislodged for something really important, take a deep breath and think about it. Does something important take precedence over your life priorities? Strategy number 2. Purge your commitments. Write down all of your personal and professional commitments and tasks for the next week or month if you know them. Review the list to see if there are any you can simply drop without serious consequence. Then review the list again to see what you might be able to delegate, delay, or shorten. If you keep something on the list because you feel guilty, obligated, or uncomfortable, test letting go of it anyway to see what happens. You might discover that you feel liberated and that the repercussions you feared don't come to pass. Strategy number 3. Focus on 3 important daily goals. Rather than trying to accomplish a laundry list of projects and tasks during your day, narrow it down to just 3 goals. Give yourself permission to do less, but with more intention, time, and focus. You can certainly tackle more if you accomplish your 3 daily goals, but having just 3 set in place gives you a sense of control, inner peace, and accomplishment without the feeling of overwhelm and urgency. Strategy number 4. Build in sacred time. Give yourself time during the day to do absolutely nothing. Sit in a chair and stare out the window, or walk outside and listen to the birds. You don't have to meditate, breathe, plan, ruminate, or do anything. Just be. Try this for 5 minutes a few times a day. Eventually, you may feel comfortable just being for an hour or more a day. Strategy number 5. Re-examine your children's schedule. Parents today aren't as willing as the previous generation of parents to allow their children to have unstructured free time. Kids are overscheduled with multiple extracurricular activities and pre-planned playdates. Couple this with a much heavier homework load and the enticements of the virtual world, and it's a wonder children spend any time at all in creative play, hanging out with family or alone with their own imaginations. Children, especially young children, require plenty of free time for their emotional health and mental development. As with adults, children can suffer from anxiety, depression, and other issues when they feel overwhelmed. Dorothy Sluss, Associate Professor of Elementary and Early Childhood Education at James Madison University, and President of the U.S. Chapter of the International Play Association, says that for every week of intensive scheduled activity or sleepaway camp, children need 3 weeks of less structured time. Parents suffer as well from overscheduling their kids. Spending hours in the car shuffling children from one activity to another is exhausting. Planning various activities for multiple children can have a severe negative impact on your mental energy. The anxiety created by hoping your child excels at t-ball or makes the traveling cheerleading squad only adds to the mental clutter in your life. It's hard to make the decision to cut back on your child's extracurricular activities, especially in a culture that idolizes competition for even the youngest. But you'll do your child and yourself a favor by finding balance between enrichment activities and complete downtime. Strategy number 6. Leave work on time. According to a recent article in the Los Angeles Times, Americans put in more hours at our jobs than any people in the industrialized world, except Koreans. We take far fewer days of vacation than Europeans. In the last several years, many among us have seen our workload double while our incomes have stayed flat. But the article goes on to say, numerous studies have indicated that people who put in too many hours at their jobs, either by choice or by requirement, become inefficient. With rare exceptions, they burn out and lose their creative edge. If you're putting in more hours than are required by your job, or you find you're sacrificing other life priorities because of the time you spend working, then you might want to reevaluate your work hours. This is especially important if you're an entrepreneur or work from home as Steve and Barry do. Even if you feel passionate about your work, being overwhelmed can still create emotional health problems if you're not balancing it with rest, relationships, and other relaxing activities. If you work excessive hours, try gradually cutting back, starting with one day a week. Leave work on time, or if you work from home, turn off your computer at 5 p.m. and commit to leaving it off for the night. Strategy number 7. Take a digital sabbatical. We've already discussed how excessive digital activities can lead to mental agitation. Even when we're not using our smartphones or laptops, they are always hovering nearby, calling to us to check in on work and see what's happening on Facebook, or luring us to play the latest game app. Although our parents had plenty of distractions, they didn't have the constant take-your-phone-to-the-bathroom habits we experience today with our devices. It's become more the exception than the norm to see someone walking down the street without a cell phone stuck to their ear or in their hands texting. It may make you hyperventilate to consider this idea, but one of the best ways to gain mental clarity in your life is to frequently take digital sabbaticals where you have no access to your cell phone, tablet, computer, or any device that connects you to the internet. Start with just one full day or weekend. Or consider using your vacation time as a digital detox where you simply relax and spend time with real people doing real-world activities. If you find that it helps you feel less stressed, then schedule these retreats into your life on a regular basis. Strategy number 8. Harness the power of flow and focus. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi is a Hungarian psychologist and pioneer in the work on understanding happiness, creativity, human fulfillment, and the notion of flow, a term he coined to describe a state of experience involving heightened focus and immersion in the activities, such as art, play, and work. He's the author of the best-selling book, Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. Csikszentmihalyi defines flow as a state in which people are so involved in an activity that nothing else seems to matter. The experience is so enjoyable that people will continue to do it even at great cost, for the sheer sake of doing it. During a flow state, a person is completely absorbed in an activity, especially one that involves creative abilities. During this activity, they feel strong, alert, in effortless control, unselfconscious, and at the peak of their abilities. They're highly focused and undistracted. Relaxation time, spent alone or with family and friends, is an excellent antidote to mental clutter. But time spent in the flow state takes it to another level. The flow state can be equated to a meditative state during which you and the activity are one, and your actions feel effortless. Your mind becomes so absorbed in the activity that you feel transported and almost forget yourself because you're so immersed in the present moment. The flow state, according to Csikszentmihalyi, is the optimal experience and the source of our greatest happiness and fulfillment. He identifies various elements involved in achieving flow, which include: there are clear goals every step of the way. There is immediate feedback to one's actions. There's a balance between challenges and skills. Action and awareness emerged. Distractions are excluded from consciousness. There is no worry of failure. Self-consciousness disappears. The sense of time becomes distorted. The activity becomes an end in itself. You can achieve flow state by doing the following. Find a challenge. Choose an activity that you enjoy doing and find somewhat challenging. It can be anything, whether it's playing the violin, writing your book, doing yoga, playing golf, or focusing on a work project. An activity with a clear set of rules or defined goals makes the challenge better because you can act without questioning what should be done or how. Develop your skills. In order to be able to meet the challenge, you have to develop your skills and become proficient. If the activity is too easy, you'll grow bored quickly, and your mind will wander, preventing you from achieving the flow state. However, if it's too hard, you'll be overwhelmed,
you won't be able to achieve that subconscious competence that is necessary for the flow state. Set clear goals. You need to be very clear on what you want to achieve with your activity and how you'll know if you're succeeding. For example, you might say, I'm going to write a chapter in my book. I'll know that I'm succeeding if I define what the chapter will be about, outline the key points I want to make, research the facts I need to include, and know how I'll structure the material. Focus intently on the task at hand. In order to maintain a flow state, you'll need to eliminate all other distractions. You don't want anything to pull your attention away from the task or disrupt the state you're in. Once your concentration is broken, you have to rebuild the flow state. Set aside enough time. It'll take you at least 15 minutes to begin to get into the flow state, and a while longer after that until you feel fully present and immersed in the activity. Once you enter the flow state, you want to have plenty of time to complete your goals and reach the peak experience. Monitor your emotional state. If you're having trouble entering the flow state, monitor your emotions. If you're in an aroused state of anxiety, try a calming exercise like breathing or meditation. If your energy level is low and you're feeling sluggish, do something to invigorate you, such as exercise, eating a healthy snack, or calling a friend. Then go back to your activity and try again. When you're highly focused in a state of flow, you are fully present with the moment. It's during these moments that your mind is the least cluttered and distracted. When you find yourself ruminating or agitated, take a few deep, calming breaths and begin a flow activity for 30 minutes to an hour or so. Give yourself enough time to become immersed in the activity, and you'll find it has a calming effect on you, in addition to helping you become more productive and happy. Simplify your distractions to overcome procrastination. Procrastination is like a credit card. It's a lot of fun until you get the bill. Christopher Parker. We all procrastinate, but putting things off until later is one of the worst offenses when it comes to cluttering your mind. When you have something hanging over your head, you never feel settled or relaxed because it's constantly niggling at you. In this age of constant distractions, we procrastinate more than ever. The phone buzzes and we look. The email dings and we click over. We have multiple tabs open on our computers, luring us away from the task at hand. Every distraction is a thief, stealing our determination to do what needs to be done or what we deeply desire to achieve. We have all the excuses we need to begin later, to pick it up tomorrow, or to finish as soon as we read just a few more Facebook posts. Distraction breeds procrastination. But procrastination is also the result of fear. Fear of failure or fear of success. It's the great what if. Standing between you and the action you want to take. Even though most of these fears are unfounded, we allow them to pull us away from the task at hand. We also procrastinate because we dread difficult tasks. We don't want to tax our brains or expend the energy necessary to get started. As you've likely experienced, the getting started part is the most difficult. Once you start, momentum carries you forward. But if you keep procrastinating, you'll never catch that wave of momentum. Procrastinating not only steals precious time and momentum we could be devoting to achievement, but also our energy and motivation. The more we procrastinate on something important, the worse we feel about ourselves. The worse we feel, the less motivation we have to get moving on our work. The less motivation we have, the more we procrastinate with mindless distractions. It's a vicious cycle that traps you in self-recriminations and anxiety. The first step in overcoming procrastination is awareness of the crippling negative impact it has on your mental state. Think about this. You likely spend at least 1 hour a day procrastinating. That's 7 hours a week, nearly a full workday. So you lose 52 full workdays a year to procrastination. What could you do with an extra 52 workdays? You could write a book, start a business, build a blog, go back to school, improve and build new personal relationships. Teach yourself a new language. Finish several big work projects. If these outcomes have convinced you about the importance of overcoming procrastination, then we recommend the following daily actions to help you get more done during your work week. 1. Plan ahead. Before bed or first thing in the morning, determine your first most important task of the day. Then decide on your second and third most important tasks. Make these tasks related to something critical in your work or business, something that will move you forward, make you more money, expand your opportunities. They shouldn't be mindless administrative tasks or filler work. 2. Define your why. Before you begin your most important task,
Ask yourself why it's so important. What is the positive motivation for pursuing this task? How will it benefit you? How will you feel when you complete it? Getting clear on the reasons why you're doing something will help you push through when you begin to feel tired or distracted. You might write down your reasons to have nearby in case you need a reminder. 3. Break it down. Break down your first most important task into all of the actions and subtasks involved in completing the main task. Write down and prioritize every action involved in finishing the task. Then estimate how much time each subtask will take and write it down. 4. Determine your schedule. What time of day are you most productive or creative? For Barry, it's first thing in the morning, when her brain is rested. However, your most productive time might be mid-afternoon. Organize your subtask priorities to maximize your most productive time. 5. Prepare what you need. Make sure you have everything you need before you sit down for your work. Get your coffee, water, or tea, and have it on your desk. Have a small, healthy snack like almonds, a banana, or some carrots to prevent your stomach from feeling too empty. Make sure the lighting is the way you want it, and your desk is organized or cleared. 6. Repeat the process. If your priority task of the day only takes a few hours, then move on to task 2 and repeat the steps above for this. Once you complete task 2, do this for task 3 as well. 7. Remove distractions. This is hugely important in helping you stay focused. When Barry was in college, she would go to a study closet in her dorm, a tiny closet-sized room with just a desk and a lamp. If she was serious about a project or preparing for a test and didn't want distractions or reasons to procrastinate, that's where she'd go. Find a space where you can work without interruptions. Turn off your phone. Close all other browsers on your computer and turn the sound off so you don't hear any dings from emails. Put a Do Not Disturb sign on your office door. 8. Begin with mindfulness. Before you begin your first subtask of your most important task for the day, close your eyes, take a few deep breaths, and set an intention that you will complete your task easily and productively. Visualize yourself accomplishing it and how you'll feel when you're done. But try not to use this moment as another reason to procrastinate. Instead, make it a 1 to 2 minute mental preparation to begin your work. 9. Set a timer. If you have a hard time focusing, set a timer for 20 to 30 minutes, or less if you have a really hard time focusing. Work diligently during that time, and when the timer goes off, allow yourself a short break to stretch, walk outside, close your eyes, or whatever feels rejuvenating. Try not to use this time to check emails, get on a long phone call, or do anything that will steal your productive time. One strategy that Steve uses to create extreme focus using a timer is the Pomodoro technique, where you focus on a single task for 25 minutes, take a 5-minute break, and then begin another 25-minute block of time. This strategy can be grueling at times, but it also helps him stay laser-focused on his most important activities. 10. Schedule longer breaks. In between your 3 most important tasks, schedule longer breaks of 15 minutes to an hour for lunch. Use these breaks to re-energize by doing some exercise or meditation, or by having a non-stressful conversation with someone. 11. Reward yourself. After you complete a task or a series of subtasks, reward yourself with either the breaks mentioned earlier or allowing yourself to check your phone, emails, or social media for a short amount of time, 10 to 15 minutes, or do something else that feels rewarding and motivating. 12. Schedule mindless tasks. Beyond your 3 most important tasks of the day, you'll certainly have mindless tasks to accomplish. If you must check emails first thing in the morning, allow yourself a short amount of time to do so, 10 to 15 minutes. Set a timer, and even if you haven't completed going through the emails, stop for now. Move on to your most important task, and come back to the emails later in the day when you've completed your tasks. Other mindless tasks like easy paperwork, organizing, or anything that doesn't take much brain power can be scheduled at your least productive times of day. Simplify your actions. Drink your tea slowly and reverently, as if it's the axis on which the earth revolves, slowly, evenly, without pushing toward the future. Live the actual moment. Only this moment is life. Thich Nhat Hanh. What if you could always be in the state of flow described earlier, where time disappears and you are one with the activity? Perhaps this would be a blissful, transformative state to live in, but you might starve, forget to pay your bills, and neglect to shower.
Real life requires that you deal with the more mundane but necessary activities of daily survival in an organized society. They're the tasks we try to get through in order to enjoy the real excitement of life, whatever that happens to be for you. Unless you're a cave dweller or live in a monastery, these real-life obligations take up a lot of time and energy. Even if you can cut back on these tasks, you can't escape all of them without some unpleasant consequences. But maybe escaping them really isn't necessary in order to declutter your mind and enjoy more of life. What if you brought mindfulness to everything you do, including the unpleasant, boring, or neutral activities of ordinary life? As Thich Nhat Hanh suggests in the quote above, rather than slurping down your tea while thinking about all you have to do today, shift your perspective to see drinking your tea as the only important thing in the world, while you're drinking it. This shift would apply to everything you do, from washing the dishes to cleaning out the cat box. Maybe you don't want to be present when cleaning the cat box, but presence is the state of mind you want to seek in everything you do. Is it possible to be present all of the time? Not really, but you can try. And if you succeed in living mindfully just a little more often, you'll discover that the joy and peace you seek is at your fingertips all the time. Let's examine 5 ways you can bring mindfulness into your daily life to become present and aware even during the most mundane activities. Number 1, eat meals mindfully. Once upon a time, people used to spend hours producing and preparing food. They would stop in the middle of a day for a big meal called dinner when everyone would leave work and sit down together to eat. Later on, dinner happened in the evening, but still it was an occasion when people sat together and spent time eating and talking. With the advent of fast food, technology, and multitasking, eating is often relegated to a quick meal between obligations, something necessary to keep us fueled for our overscheduled lives. Not only do we neglect the ritual of family meals, but too often we overlook the simple joy of eating. We may not have as much time to focus on food preparations as our grandmothers did, but we can be mindful of the food we eat and how we experience a meal. This means not eating in front of the TV or computer, but rather sitting with your family or alone in a quiet, distraction-free place. Here are a few thoughts on mindful eating. Before you eat, look at the food and notice the colors, smells, and textures. Close your eyes and breathe in the aromas. Notice your own hunger and urge to eat. When you put the first bite of food into your mouth, notice the immediate tastes and sensations. As you chew, notice how the tastes might change or expand. Chew and swallow your food slowly, with a thought of gratitude for the hands that prepared it. As you continue to eat, notice how your stomach feels as you satiate your appetite. Be aware of feeling full and cease eating when you are. Don't feel obligated to overeat in order to clean your plate. After you finish the meal, sit down for a few moments and digest your food. After the meal, mindfully wash your plate and utensils and put them away. When you eat mindfully, not only will you savor the experience of eating, but you'll also support proper digestion and absorption of nutrients. Studies show eating slowly leads to improved satiety and reduced calorie intake. Number 2. Clean your house mindfully. Thich Nhat Hanh has said that he washes dishes with as much care as if he were bathing the newborn Buddha. If I'm incapable of washing dishes joyfully, if I want to finish them quickly so I can go and have a cup of tea, then I'll be incapable of drinking the tea joyfully. Rather than organizing your house as a means to a decluttered mind, focus on the doing rather than the getting it done. Cleaning won't magically become an elevated experience, but you will be elevated by simply paying attention to the elegant cause and effect of cleaning. Try to see house cleaning as a laboratory for being present and engaged in life. This mind shift can be applied to any routine task: washing your car, mowing the lawn, or even paying the bills. You can approach these tasks with dread and resentment, or you can approach them with your full attention and a sense of gratitude that you're able to accomplish them, that they improve your life, and that, however insignificant, they are worthy of your time. Number 3. Walk mindfully. As Barry writes in her book, Peace of Mindfulness, taking a walk you can be mindful by listening intently to your feet hitting the ground and the sounds of nature around you. Take in the scenery you observe, the feeling of the warm or cool air, and the smells of being outside. Whenever you're walking, either indoors or out, whatever your destination, pay attention along the way. You don't have to hustle along with your eye on the outcome. Let walking be the destination. Number 4. Experience nature mindfully. Numerous studies have shown the mental and physical benefits of spending time in nature. Being in forests and green spaces can boost the immune system, lower blood pressure, reduce stress, improve your mood, increase your ability to focus, accelerate recovery from surgery or illness, increase your energy level, improve your sleep.